Hello, this is Kathy, and this is the Taunton Daily Gazette for Wednesday, August 19th, 2026. Taunton Settling with Marijuana Biz by Daniel Schemer. It looks like Taunton intends to settle with the Commonwealth Alternative Care City Council President Barry Sanders announced at the August 11th City Council meeting. The city intends to reimburse the cannabis company millions in disputed revenues collected by the city. Sanders said the council voted unanimously in executive session to authorize $2.4 million from one of the city's capital stabilization accounts to be refunded back to Commonwealth Alternative Care. The executive session vote was then ratified by the full council on the same night. The amount represents a reimbursement of community impact fees, which have been subject to scrutiny, as well as the basis for litigation that has popped up between dispensaries and municipalities all over the state in the past few years. Cannabis company sues Taunton. Commonwealth Alternative Care, currently located inside warehouse space at 30A Monzon Boulevard, filed a complaint in Bristol Superior Court on March 30th. The complaint was originally for the amount of $3.3 million paid out by the company to the city over 5 years, from 2019 to 2023, as part of an agreed-upon community impact fees that were part of its host community agreement. These fees were paid when Commonwealth was both a medical and recreational sales dispensary in the city. Since early 2025, it has shifted to being just a manufacturing and cultivation facility. Community impact fees were established by the Cannabis Control Commission as a means to compensate municipalities for any direct costs they incur hosting cannabis businesses, such as police overtime or police details related to security or traffic control for the establishments, impact studies related to traffic and the environment, or municipal educational programs related to marijuana use. An annual community impact fee for any cannabis business amounted to as much as 3% of the business's sales. The complaint stated that every year during the five-year period, Commonwealth Alternative Care requested records of the anticipated and actual expenses related to these fees. The city, the complaint alleged, never submitted any expense records to them and even told the company there weren't any incurred costs each year. The complaint alleged the collection of fees from the start were unlawful because they were never reasonably related to the operation of the facility, and the city's apparent lack of costs or expenses incurred in relation to the facility demonstrate conclusively that the city had no legal basis to collect the community impact fees. Statewide scrutiny of community impact fees. Over the last several years, dispensaries across the state have been challenging the collection of these community impact fees, with critics saying there's been little accountability and oversight over them. A sweeping cannabis reform bill signed by then-Governor Charlie Baker in August 2022 aimed to crack down on the fees and increase oversight by the Cannabis Control Commission. The city of Taunton had ceased collecting community impact fees from cannabis businesses by March 2024. What do city and Commonwealth Alternative Care say about the settlement? Attorney Matthew Costa from the city's law department declined to comment regarding the litigation with the Commonwealth Alternative Care, except to say the settlement agreed has not yet been finalized. The Gazette could not reach Commonwealth Alternative Care or its parent company, Arizona-based Tilt Holdings Incorporated, by phone or email as of Friday afternoon, August 14th. The Gazette reached out to Commonwealth Alternative Care's legal representation for the case. Vincente LLP, located in Boston, for comment on the negotiated settlement, but no response was received. Patient violence rising, local nurses say, by Henry Schwann. Sarah Walker always knew she wanted to be a nurse. For the past 10 years, the 44-year-old Rutland native has worked as an emergency room nurse at UMass Memorial Health Alliance, Clinton Hospital, Leominster campus. I've always wanted to be in healthcare. I love chaos. What Walker doesn't love is taking verbal abuse from some patients, which can escalate into physical assaults. Walker says she's been spit on, scratched, and struck. She had surgery and missed 16 months of work from injuries after trying to hold down a patient who became violent and threatened to harm himself. Workers' compensation paid 60% of Walker's salary while she recovered, but it wasn't enough to cover her bills. She was forced to sell her home and use some of the proceeds to meet her expenses. Walker suffered another patient attack in January and hasn't been able to work since because of her injuries. She's scheduled for surgery in the coming days. "I'm just terrified that there's going to be a day when I don't come home," said Walker. "I'm terrified that I'll lose a coworker." Walker claims she repeatedly asked UMass Memorial Health for police details in the hospital to protect the staff against violent patients, but nothing has changed. Mall cops is how she described what's there now. Demand for better safety. Walker belongs to the Massachusetts Nurses Association, which demands more protection for workers. The union supports pending legislation at the State House that would require employers to develop and implement programs to prevent workplace violence in hospitals and other healthcare settings. The Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association and the Service Employees International Union, 1199, which represents nearly 80,000 healthcare workers in Massachusetts, backs the bill. There is currently no requirement that healthcare facilities report assaults to state agencies, according to the union. Plus, district attorneys learn about assaults only if they're felonies. The union believes those issues mean a scarcity of data on the number of actual assaults. The Massachusetts Department of Labor Standards, which is responsible for protecting worker safety, should receive the data, said the union, along with State Department of Public Health, which licenses hospitals and district attorneys. State law requires hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers to report serious reportable events to the State Department of Public Health. The state's definition of serious reportable events focuses on injuries to patients. There is also a category for potential criminal events. The numbers in that category for hospitals statewide that offer a high level of care are publicly reported through 2022, which show physical assaults in Massachusetts hospitals jumped from 45 in 2018 to 80 in 2022. Over half of those assaults that resulted in serious injury were cases of patients attacking clinical staff, security officers, or EMTs. Encounters that often led to missed work time. Assaults on the uptick. The union believes violence in healthcare settings is on the rise. It claims nearly 7 out of 10 nurses in Massachusetts report having experienced an assault in the workplace. The Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association reports that every 36 minutes, a Massachusetts healthcare worker is subjected to physical assault, verbal abuse, or threat. Massachusetts House and Senate lawmakers have separate bills to address violence in hospitals and other healthcare locations, but failed to reach a compromise by July 31st, the end of the formal legislative session. New rules allow lawmakers to continue discussions on a comprised bill until the end of this year. Both versions would require facilities to conduct annual assessments of workplace violence and develop plans to minimize safety risks. Employee training and mandated reporting of violent incidents are included in the proposals. local district attorneys would receive the reports and they would be made public. Employees who need time off because of injuries and to pursue legal action against their attackers would not be forced by employers to use vacation, sick, or personal time to cover any missed days. Backlash from employers for missed time is prohibited. Anyone who assaults healthcare staff during working hours could face jail time, fines, or both. Misdemeanor or felony? There is a major difference in the bills. The Senate version classifies assaults as misdemeanors, while the House ups the ante to felonies. The Senate bill permits so-called warrantless arrests that allow authorities to arrest and detain a person if there's probable cause to believe someone committed a misdemeanor. State Senator Robin Kennedy, a Worcester Democrat, compared the proposal to domestic violence cases when an arrest is made under probable cause, even if a police officer didn't witness the crime. Walker, a nurse in Leominster, supports tougher penalties, noting one of the patients who attacked her was only put on probation. If someone has a mental health crisis, we're not going after them, said Walker. We want the average Joe in the ER who gets mad because he has to wait and starts yelling and hitting. We're trying to hold them accountable. Kennedy added an amendment to the warrantless arrest proposal that calls for further investigation into how to handle assaults committed by patients with developmental disabilities, including attacks against staff in group home settings. The bill's language includes patients with a mental health or behavioral health diagnosis. As Kennedy sees it, those assaults may not include intentional or malicious harm due to the person's developmental challenges. Her amendment calls for a one-year pause on all warrantless arrests, except in hospitals, if a final bill including her amendment is signed into law. That way, there's more time for experts to determine how to address assaults perpetrated by people with developmental disabilities. It's critical to get a bill done, said Kennedy. Too many healthcare workers on the front lines face violence in their place of work. It's simply unacceptable and should not be tolerated. Local perspective. UMass Memorial Health said in a statement that it supports what state lawmakers are doing to develop clear and enforceable standards to prevent workplace violence. It lauded efforts to include healthcare workers and unions in crafting regulations. The healthcare system noted it already has procedures in place to protect workers that were developed with input from staff who work directly with the patients. The steps vary by hospital and include metal detection in emergency departments, police officers staffed at Memorial and University campuses in Worcester, and a behavioral emergency response team to de-escalate patients who show signs of emotional distress. Also, visitors are screened and monitored. Campus police participate in active shooter training. Staff have ongoing safety training, and the health system has a conduct policy for patients and families. Family Health Center in Worcester, which serves more than 30,000 patients, reports no patient assaults of staff, according to the center's leadership. However, officials noted a rise in patient threats to themselves and employees. Our priority is safety for both patients and staff, said the center's email to the Telegram and a Gazette. To meet the standards, officials said employees are encouraged to report instances when patients become increasingly agitated, so there's a quick response. Family Health Center also hires security teams from Metro Crime Prevention, a private security contractor based in Worcester, to patrol its facilities. St. Vincent Hospital, owned by for-profit Tenet Healthcare Corporation in Dallas, declined to comment for this story. More calls for increased safety. Walker isn't the only person working in the UMass Memorial Health Hospital in Leominster who demands better safety. Miko Nakawaga, a nurse who works in the post-anesthesia care unit and previously worked 20 years in the hospital's emergency room, said she was assaulted several times by patients in the ER. The most serious attack happened in 2017 when a patient shoved Nakawaga into a stretcher, resulting in a torn rotator cuff. After two surgeries and many months out of work, Nakawaga said, I'm in a lot of pain all the time. Charges she brought against her attacker resulted in probation. We really need a law to protect all healthcare workers, she said. Walker couldn't agree more. She believes if nothing is done to force hospitals to have firm plans in place to protect staff and face accountability if they fall short, it's only a matter of time before people get hurt worse than me or killed. She added, all we want to do is go to work and take care of patients and then go home to our families. Leavitt exit fuels buzz on successor. By Joey Garrison, USA Today. Caroline Leavitt's sudden announcement that she will soon be stepping down as White House press secretary has fueled widespread speculation about President Donald Trump's upcoming pick to replace her. Plenty of names are being floated as Trump prepares to choose his next chief spokesperson and one of the top faces of the Trump administration. Leavitt, who cited her desire to spend more time with her two young children, formally departs the White House at the end of August. Leavitt used the position to set the tone for the president's agenda and the administration's response to attacks from opponents. Trump often has an eye toward what he calls central casting for the part when he fills the White House staff and cabinet positions. Trump likes those who are telegenic and speak with authority, characteristics that are prerequisites for a very public role as press secretary. Five of the six press secretaries across Trump's two terms in the office have been women. Trump has not indicated who he may pick, but here are the names, 10 names, receiving early speculation as potential Leavitt replacements. Alina Haba, a former personal attorney for Trump, gained notoriety in 2024 as the president's defense counsel during his legal proceedings in New York. She made frequent appearances in front of television cameras on Trump's behalf. After his 2024 election victory, Trump named Haba counselor to the president. He later nominated her as the top federal prosecutor in New Jersey. In December, Haba resigned as U.S. attorney for the District of New Jersey after a federal appeals court ruled she was serving in the role unlawfully because she was never confirmed by Congress. Conservative political commentator Scott Jennings. He is known for his spirited arguments with Democrats as a senior political contributor for CNN. The Kentucky native, who also hosts a radio show, last year published a glowing book about Trump titled A Revolution of Common Sense, How Donald Trump Stormed Washington and Fought Western Civilization. Anna Kelly. Anna Kelly currently serves under Leavitt in the White House Press Secretary Office as Principal Deputy Press Secretary. The White House has increasingly deployed Kelly in front of the camera for interviews with Fox, primarily discussing the Iran war and other foreign policy items. Katie Miller. Katie Miller, former press secretary for Vice President Mike Pence and wife of Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, is a known commodity in the Trump world. Miller worked as a top aide for Trump administration's Department of Government Efficiency, led by tech executive Elon Musk. She stepped down last August to launch her own podcast, where she frequently interviews Trump officials. Her guests have included Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Matthew Boyle. Matthew Boyle, Washington's bureau chief of conservative outlet Breitbart, could get a look if Trump wants a press secretary with close ties to conservative media. Boyle has interviewed Trump multiple times, including in the Oval Office in June. The New York Post reported Boyle is an early front-runner for the job, calling him a favorite among well-connected Trump allies who recognize the dogged Breitbart scribe's fiery but steady presence in conservative media ecosystems. Stephen Chuang. Stephen Chuang, a longtime loyal Trump communications aide known for his tough, no-nonsense approach, could be considered for press secretary if Trump wants to appoint from within the White House. Chuang leads the White House Communications Office in Trump's second term as Communications Director. Chuang works primarily behind the scenes, however. Taylor Budowich, a longtime Trump advisor, left the White House last September for the private sector after serving as Deputy Chief of Staff. In his former role, Budowich saw White House communications and cabinet affairs. He previously worked as Trump's 2020 campaign spokesman and helped him manage the pro-Trump super PAC known as Make America Great Again, Incorporated. Roma Duravi, who served as Deputy Communications Director during Trump's first term, is currently Vice President of Public Relations at the Kennedy Center, which Trump has worked to overhaul. Jason Miller, another longtime trusted Trump aide and campaign spokesperson, joined the Trump White House this summer to work on messaging before the November midterm elections. Miller worked in senior capacities for all three of Trump's presidential runs and has frequently defended the president in front of television cameras and other reporters. After the 2024 election, Miller worked as a lobbyist before returning to work for Trump. Carrie Lake. Another name bandied around is Carrie Lake, the former news anchor who lost Arizona's elections for governor in 2022 and U.S. Senate in 2024. Trump is a big fan of Lake. However, in May, he nominated Lake to be his U.S. ambassador to Jamaica, a role that would prevent her from being his press secretary. Iran faces growing economic pressure by Parissa Havezi, Dubai. Even as Iran projects resilience in the war with the United States, its leaders are worried that a threat of more economic punishment by President Donald Trump could increase hardships, reignite unrest, and further erode the Islamic Republic's legitimacy. Trump vowed on August 14th to hit Iran hard economically, a day after Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said Washington would impose those measures on Tehran that have never been seen. Washington has not said what those measures would entail. For all the bravado of Iran's leaders, after holding out in nearly 6 months of conflict and effectively closing the Strait of Hormuz, a vital global oil supply route, they face mounting pressure at home that could result in nationwide unrest, according to three Iranian officials. The officials, two political insiders, a former Iranian official and a dozen ordinary Iranians, spoke to Reuters on condition of anonymity, either for fear of retribution or because they are not authorized to speak to media. Iran entered the war with high inflation, a weakening currency, energy shortages, sanctions, and deep structural weaknesses, and must now contend with damaged infrastructure, disrupted trade, lost production, and the cost of rebuilding. Arshia, a civil engineer, spent a decade working in Iran's construction industry before the war that began with the U.S. and Israeli attacks on February 28th brought projects largely to a standstill. He is now struggling to find work as projects are delayed or canceled or costs soar, with little prospect of rapid recovery. I'm worried. If Trump imposes more sanctions, how will ordinary people survive? I don't want my country to be punished militarily or economically. We're already struggling, said the father of two from the central city of Isfahan. His plight reflects a broader reality across Iran, where U.S. strikes damaged factories, power plants, transport networks, and other critical infrastructure, adding to pressure on an already strained economy. Mohsen, 53, was forced to shut his small import-export business with Gulf countries after Iran retaliated against U.S. strikes by targeting American bases and assets in the region. I had to lay off 10 employees. It was painful, but I had no choice. I could no longer afford to pay their salaries, and now I'm relying on my savings to support my family, he said from the southern port of Bandar Abbas. Iran's annual inflation rate reached 66% in July, while consumer prices were 87.9% higher than a year earlier, according to Iran's statistical center. Food inflation hit 128% year on year. The recent appointment of Hossein Tabe a key architect of past crackdowns to lead Iran's Basi militia is one of the clearest signs yet of a growing concern over resurgence of unrest, a former reformist official said. The Basi, a military volunteer militia, is affiliated with Iran's powerful Revolutionary Guards, which have both been used by the clerical rulers to quell protests. Economic grievances have repeatedly spilled into nationwide protests in Iran in recent years. In January, protests over economic hardships were crushed by the two forces, with thousands killed. In recent months, Iran's clerical rulers have responded to fears of renewed unrest with executions, arrests, summonses, and lengthy prison sentences targeting journalists, lawyers, activists, human rights activists, and students' rights groups, say. Families are cutting back on meat and other staples, opting for cheaper alternatives. I'm ashamed in front of my children. My salary is gone within days. Meat and chicken have disappeared from our table. I have no idea how we're going to get by, said Hussan, a government employee in the central city of Yazd. Rents rose 31% year over year in March, according to the Statistical Center, while state media reported Tehran housing prices at roughly 50% above last year. Iran's minimum wage raised about 60% this year, but continued while depreciation has eroded purchasing power, with the dollar value of minimum wage falling from about $105 to $86 since late March. Brian Forty earned about $1,000 a month as an engineer when he entered the job market 15 years ago. He has since turned to online tutoring to make ends meet. Now he and his wife struggle to make about $400 a month and have left Tehran for a cheaper province. I used to work maybe 5 or 6 hours a day. Now it's all work or looking for work or feeling anxious about not having enough work, Pian said. For many Iranians, fear of renewed conflict has made planning for the future increasingly difficult. Iran has sought to keep essential goods moving through alternative routes, including land corridors and the Caspian Sea, but those alternatives are also coming under strain. Strikes on bridges have disrupted overland transport, increasing the cost and time needed to move goods to Iran. President Masoud Pezeshkian recently acknowledged the squeeze, saying our problems have multiplied several times over while our income has also fallen. Goods that once arrived by ship now take longer routes to Iran, driving up prices, he said, adding that Iran is selling less oil and collecting less tax revenue from damaged or struggling businesses.